Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Itay Itzan, and he is author of Awareness is Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality. Dr. Itay Itzan is passionate about the combination of psychology and spirituality. It makes his heart sing. He is a positive psychologist, a senior lecturer, and a program leader of MAPP, M-A-P-P, which is a Master's in Applied Positive Psychology, at the University of East London. For the last 15 years, Dr. Itzan has run seminars, lectures, workshops, and retreats in the UK and around the world in various educational institutions and private events. Dr. Itay has established the Awareness is Freedom Project, which is grounded on a combination of positive psychology and spiritual theories, models, and practical work with the aim of creating more awareness in your life. For more information, you can visit his website, which is awarenessisfreedom.com, and I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Itay to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, Robert, and good evening.
It is my pleasure. I enjoyed reading your book. Anytime that I can learn more about myself through another's writings, I'm always happy. So, and your book is one of those that helps someone learn. So I appreciate that. Let's start by giving our listeners just a little bit of an understanding of, you know, of your work, what you term as positive psychology and the whole focus of awareness. So if you wouldn't mind maybe explaining to our listeners a little bit about, you know, the idea of positive psychology.
Of course. So, first of all, I think that the center of my work is within this field of positive psychology. And in positive psychology, we're saying that Western psychology has been focusing for many, many years on the simple question of what is wrong with us so that we could fix that which is wrong. And I think it is an important perspective, and we do need to be able to support those in need and it's an important aspect of psychology. But in positive psychology, we're saying, wait a second, this coin, it has a flip side. It, there's another side to it. And that other side is the important question of what is right with us, what is beautiful in human beings, what are our strengths, what are our virtues, and as part of that, how could we enhance these beautiful aspects of being human? So, for example, we research happiness and we research resilience, and we research courage and inspiration and meaning in life and mindfulness meditation that I'm going to talk about later today. So all those wonderful aspects of being human, that's the center of research, but not only research, not only theory, but also practical interventions, exercises, so that people could actually find ways to apply these important insights and transform their lives.
Yeah, well, you know, that was one of the things that I enjoy about that approach, is the focus on, you know, what is right and not necessarily, you know, what is wrong and what needs fixing, even though, you know, there are, you know, that is a part of life, because there are things that do prevent us from living life to its fullest.
Oh, absolutely. I think that there's an important point to do with positive psychology that I should emphasize. Normally, when I ask students or groups first time I introduced positive psychology, I asked him, you know, what is the first thing that comes to mind when I say positive psychology? Most people would say, you know, a smiley face or happiness or optimism. And it's true that these concepts are part of positive psychology. But I invite you and the listeners to think about positive psychology in a broader sense and understand that we're talking about positive outcomes. So yes, indeed, in positive psychology, we would like to see people change positively and get to a point where they grow and there's positive transformation. But the path towards this positive transformation could go through pain, sadness, trauma, challenges, difficulties. So the point I'm trying to make is that we're not only dealing with positive experiences, we could also deal with what we might refer to as negative experiences, but we'd like to find ways for people to transform these so-called negative experiences into something that allows positive growth and transformation. And perhaps the best example for that is something that in positive psychology we refer to as post-traumatic growth, where there's a lot of research and a lot of theory and a lot of interventions to do with the way we could work with trauma in a way that would allow us to be with it, embrace it, and then positively change following it.
Yeah, well, you know, trauma, you know, and the and coping with it and the transformation of that energy into something positive seems to be a major focus. I mean, there are just so many people that are, you know, particularly, you know, those who are involved in war or people who have a violent kind of experience in life or something that really shakes them to the core. You know, it really does seem that, you know, it's transformational in one way, because first of all, it shakes everyone's foundation, or the person's foundation, you know, as far as security and you know, all of those kinds of things, but also, you know, coming on the other side of that, you know, can be a challenge.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's a huge challenge, and I think that in many ways, alongside the challenge and alongside the difficulty, there's also an opportunity, that is part of what you just referred to as the shaking of our foundation, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The shaking of, because, you know, we all go through life and we establish a very solid understanding of what's right and what's wrong, and we feel that this allows us to feel that life is safe and life is stable and secure, and then something comes along, and it always comes along. It might be very powerful, and then it might be a trauma, and it might be less intense, and then it won't be referred to as a trauma, but just a difficulty. But something always comes along and shakes us. I think it's an inevitable dimension of life. We have been someone close to us has died. Romantic relationship has been broken. We have been fired from work. Something will come and shake us, and I think this particular moment when these things happen, they are very, very important, because they could be a moment where we crumble and lose the awareness of what are we going through at the moment. In what way is it an invitation for me to change? Or we could bring in that awareness, observe the process we go through, which includes the pain and the sadness, which includes the embracing of the difficulty, but keep that awareness, keep that knowledge of how am I changing as a result of this challenge that is happening to me right here, right now. And then I think this is when the miracles happen, because then the shaking of the foundation that you refer to, and I think it's a beautiful way to conceptualize the experience, then the shaking of the foundation allows space for new things, new ways of being, new ways of relating to life, to ourselves, the understanding that we are much more than what we used to think that we are, that the self is such an expanded experience compared with the almost narrow version that we have in our own minds. So I think from that point of view, the challenge is almost always also an invitation for growth.
Yeah, it does, you know, and you know, I think that, you know, just the process of shaking up our world, that in itself is, I think, really what happens many times for people who, in order to get some forward movement, to kind of get out of a position of stagnation, you know, or, you know, the lack of growth, that it seems that many times those kinds of situations occur just for that very purpose of forcing a different perspective.
Absolutely. I think from a psychological point of view, I think most of that is happening on an unconscious level. So if we would ask the person, he or she, they would never say that they've made the choice that led to such difficulty because they wanted to shake their foundation. But I think something within us knows precisely what we need. And when we get to this point that you described, the point where we feel that our soul is stuck, that our spirit isn't expanding, that there's no feeling of growth and movement in our lives, and we all know that. You called it stagnation. That's exactly what I'm referring to. And in that space, there's a feeling of emptiness. I teach a lot the topic of meaning in life, for example, and I think it's such a beautiful topic, and research is showing the huge impact that meaning has on our well-being. So, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you get out of bed and you know why you get out of bed, you have the simple answer to this why. It empowers you. It gives you a real feeling of vitality. We show through studies that these people who know their why, they show greater passion to their work, greater quality of relationships, romantic relationships, friendships, family. They are more courageous. They feel more inspired, so there are a lot of positive. They experience greater positive emotions, so it has a huge impact. And I'm saying all of that in the context of feeling stuck, because I feel that very frequently, this feeling of stagnation, this feeling of I'm stuck, life is empty. Part of that is the fact that we lack this personal meaning. And just to emphasize, by saying meaning, I'm not referring to the question, you know, what is the meaning of life. I'm just talking about this personal knowledge. You know, why am I here? What is my personal meaning? What is my purpose? And how can I make it happen? So how can I apply it in my life? And when I find ways to do that, beautiful things happen.
Yeah, I agree. Now, your book talks about awareness. You know, is awareness is freedom. So would you mind kind of giving your definition or perspective of exactly what awareness is?
Okay.
It sounds kind of basic, but, you know, I mean, some people sometimes, you know, just aren't aware what awareness is.
I completely agree with you. I think it's important to start with the basics. And when I say awareness, I'm not talking about anything sophisticated or any you know, grand concept. For me, awareness is simply a movement of attention. So when I'm aware, it means that my attention is right there with whatever's happening. And more specifically, for me, awareness refers to the awareness of the self, myself, which begins with, as I said earlier, this sort of narrow conceptualization of a self that is filled with definitions of who and what am I, and then through the spiritual journey grows into an expanded self that includes all. But it does begin with a simple awareness, which is noticing who am I, noticing what's moving within me. And it's almost, you know, it's very interesting because for me, awareness is a skill. It's a skill that we could enhance. And obviously, I, I believe that the greatest way to enhance that skill is meditation. So when we meditate regularly, we get an enhanced sense of what is moving within us and who and what we are at a given moment. In other words, we become aware of what's happening.
There was one comment in your book that I really liked, and maybe you can expand on it a little bit, and that is that as your awareness expands, you develop the ability and find the inner space and time to stop automatic conditioned reactions. And I thought, boy, there's so much truth in that. But would you mind kind of talking a little bit about that? Because I think that kind of feeds into the idea of awareness leading to freedom.
Absolutely. So maybe before I go into the explanation of the quote, I'll say a few words about the other half of the book's name, so The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality. So why is it that I believe that psychology and spirituality are both required for that experience of awareness as freedom? And then it'll be much easier for me to go into the explanation. For me, spirituality is the experience of transcendence. When I refer to transcendence, I'm talking about the transcendence of the self. So spirituality is the experience of moving beyond the definitions of a personal self and then connecting with life and experiencing life with a deep, deep, deep sense of connection to everything. And when we are at that space, and obviously this could only be experienced, using words to describe that space is a little bit funny, but when we are at that space, we feel this incredible happiness and peace and deep, deep love and compassion. And when I teach the topic of spirituality, I invite my students to imagine that underneath their sense of self, there's a river that is flowing continuously. Every moment of our lives, this river is running underneath the sense of self, and we're always invited to dive into the water of this river. And when we do that, this is when we move beyond the self, we transcend the self, and we feel that beautiful happiness, peace, and love, which are not dependent upon anything. So normally when we talk about happiness, it's more about something that, for example, happened in my life, and then as a result of that, I feel happy. But that river had nothing to do with any event. It's that which I am. And when I swim in the water of this river, this is an incredible experience of bliss and transcendence. And for me, this is what spirituality is inviting as a journey. So that's spirituality. Now, psychology then comes along. And I'm obviously giving sort of a brief description of this process, but psychology comes along because I need to know, as part of my spiritual growth, what is it that I'm going to transcend. So I wholeheartedly believe that it's impossible for us to transcend that which we don't know. In other words, I need to develop an intimate relationship with myself. I need to get to know myself. I need to learn building blocks of this thing that I call itai. And only by intimately coming to know these building blocks, only then can I transcend itai, can I transcend these bits and pieces that create myself. Therefore, psychology and the psychological process of learning the self is essential for the experience of spirituality, for transcendence. And this is where psychology and spirituality come together. Psychology allows us the movement towards the invitation to transcend and to experience spirituality. So that's the foundation of my work in just a few sentences. And now I can go back to your question or to the quote you've read, where I've said that awareness allows us to move beyond these obstacles that the self creates. When we go through life, we tend to think that We tend to think that things happen to us randomly. But in reality, it is the particular sense of self that we have and the particular expectations and needs and understandings that we carry as part of our personal self that create that which we experience. So, you know, if I have certain understandings about romantic relationships, I will probably find obstacles within my romantic relationships that involve these particular bits and pieces of myself where these understandings, expectations, and needs to do with romantic relationships are sitting within myself. And therefore, in order for me to be able to move beyond these obstacles within my romantic relationships, I would have to engage with these aspects of myself where these expectations are sitting, or needs, or ideas, or whatever. So I need to learn to see them, and then I need to learn how to work with them, and we'll talk about that later. How do we work with these obstacles? Because this is where meditation comes in. But I think that there's no other way for me to move beyond the obstacle. I mean, the option that a lot of people choose when these obstacles come along is turn their back and run away in a different direction.
Yeah.
But the funny thing about life is that there's one single thing we cannot run away from, and it's ourselves. Because wherever we'll go, whatever we'll do, ourselves will always be there with us. As long as we breathe, it's there as part of our life experience. And the interesting thing is then, if you really notice your own life, you'll see that things are happening in patterns. Patterns that repeat themselves again and again and again. And the reason for that is that as long as we turn away from a challenge and move in a new direction, we will find a way to manifest the same challenge, obviously with a different face in a different place. It doesn't matter. It'll be the same challenge because that piece of the self is still sitting within us. So it's only by bringing awareness to it and working with it that we could become free of it.
Wow. And the one of the things I want to let people know too is in your book you spend some time going through the process of helping people kind of get in touch with themselves. What are various aspects of themselves, and then you have exercises and things for people to work on, which I enjoy. There were several of them that I went through, and it's like, oh, okay, I didn't realize that about myself. But, and I think just the process of going through those exercises helped raise my awareness of, Robert, who he is, really kind of at the essence of my beliefs. And I think, that then can lead me to making different decisions or, maybe shaking up my belief system a little bit and replacing some old, outdated tapes.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, I love what you're saying because, the reason for the fact that these exercises are prominent in the book, for me, they are more important than anything else in the book. The reason for that is that I truly believe that spirituality and growth, they are hard work. They really truly involve an active engagement with ourselves. I sometimes meet people who go for dozens of years from workshop to workshop, from class to class, from retreat to retreat. They ask me, why is it that nothing's happening? And they go to these workshops, they go to these retreats, but then they go back home and there's no real application, there's no real questioning. And I think that this isn't, well, it's not enough to engage. There's a beautiful story about the Buddha where one of his disciples approached him after one of his classes, and he said to him, my dear Buddha, I wanted to ask you, I see a lot of my friends who joined with me, they joined your classes a few years ago, and they've they've transformed so beautifully. And I think of myself and I observe myself, nothing really happened. And I don't know, can you help me to understand what's happening here? And the Buddha asked him, well, I can see you're here for my evening talk on Sundays, but are you joining our meditation sessions during the week? And the guy says, no, I only have time to come in on Sunday and hear you speak. Well, says the Buddha, I can see that you are not from this particular city, right? The guy says, yes, that is true. And where are you from? And so the guy says, I'm from Rajasthan. He says, well, that's great. So you must have had people who asked you how to get to Rajasthan, the path to the road to Rajasthan. I said, yes, of course, a lot of my friends did. And did you help them? I said, yes, of course. I drew a map and I've explained the way. He says, wonderful, the Buddha. And therefore, have they all been to Rajasthan? I said, no. Some of them talking about it, and they haven't actually went and done the actual journey. Well, said the Buddha, this is it. You have a choice. I can draw a map for you, and I can describe the road, and we can talk about the path till the end of times. But at some point, you would have to start walking that path. And for me, these exercises are the signposts. They're an invitation. And I also wholeheartedly believe, and I know from the experience of my students, that when you do engage with these exercises, it's as if we put a key into the lock and we open the door, and then a lot of things happen, things that might have begun with the exercises, but it's as if the exercise just pushed the boulder from the top of the mountain, but then it starts rolling down the mountain and it grabs things along the way, and then a lot of independent things start to happen. And for me, that's the beauty of the engagement with ourselves, because we don't know what's going to happen. By the way, that's also the reason why it's really scary.
Yeah, it can be. But, you know, that's correct. You know, that once you put the key in and actually open up that door, you know, to a different way of thinking, a different perspective, different ideas, you know, as you go through life and experience day to day, you naturally run into experiences that hit on, you know, some of those beliefs. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, I remember when I looked into that door, you know, this was something that I needed to look at again, you know. So it's it really, I think, kind of sets the stage for a different path, you know. I mean, a different way of thinking, different choices. And I think, you know, that really... choices and actions are kind of what decide our life experience. So I think, you know, it's if we have a better awareness of who we are, you know, and what we, you know, want to, you know, kind of manifest into our life, then it makes it easier then to make educated types of choices.
Exactly. Yeah. I think you've made the I think this is the perfect way to think about this, because if we make choices with awareness, they will be so much more accurate. They will be so much more right for us, because we understand the underlying motivations. We understand the greater context of why am I moving towards this? Why is this appealing to me? And therefore, I can make a conscious choice as to whether or not this is right for me. And that's the kind of choice I can only make if I truly investigate within myself what leads me towards that choice. And in order to make such an investigation, I need to engage with myself. It's inevitable.
Yeah, exactly. Itai, I want to take just a quick 90-second break. And then when we come back, I want to move on. You have a section in your book called Religion versus Spirituality. And, you know, in that particular section, you talk about a study that you did in relation to religion, spirituality, and an achieving a sense of well-being. You know, and I thought that that was a really interesting study, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that when we return, okay?
Excellent.
Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back in about 90 seconds.
This is Robert Sharp from Bringing Inspiration to Earth. There are several ways for a win-win situation where you can support our work and you receive a quality product. You can purchase the book or ebook of Joy Potential or It's No Secret Spirituality Bites. Each book has helped readers shift their perspective away from negativity towards a happier, less stressful life. Or you can shop at our wellness store where we offer essential oils, personal care, and wellness products. I am a very frugal shopper, and these are high-quality items I use that really contribute to my well-being. Or you can purchase our amazing nature photo greeting cards. These are great all-occasion, unique 5x7 folding cards. They're my most popular nature photos, and everyone who has received one raves about the scene. All options are available at our website, www.biteradio.me, and I am very appreciative of your support of our efforts and the work of our special radio guests.
To greater well-being in the context of religion and spirituality. So we've studied participants, and we've divided them into groups where we've measured two different measures. The first measure was their religious activity, religious participation. So, you know, how many times do I go to the church or the mosque or the synagogue? How many times a day do I pray? And so on and so forth. So these are the activities that are part of religion, being religious. And we've also measured their levels of spirituality. So their experiences of transcendence that I referred to earlier, meditation or other spiritual practices that are part of their religion. So we have a religious activity, we have levels of spirituality, and then we also have levels of well-being. So basically, at that point, what we get is four different groups. We have a group that is high in religious activity and high in spirituality. So these people practice their religion, but they're also experiencing a lot of spirituality in their lives. We have a group who is low religious activity but high spirituality. So they're not really practicing a lot of their religion, but they're high in their experience of spirituality. We have those with high religious activity, so they're very active with their religion, but there's very little experience of actual spirituality. And then we have a fourth group where they are low in both of them, both in religious activity and low in spirituality. The most interesting piece of data from the study is very simple. The highest levels of well-being were found with the two groups who had high levels of spirituality. So the first group was the one with religious activity and spirituality, and the second group with high levels of well-being are those with high spirituality but no religious activity. So spirituality came up as a very fundamental aspect of the experience of well-being. And actually, it's very interesting to notice that the lowest levels of well-being were found for individuals with low levels of spirituality and high levels of religious activity. In other words, and this is very interesting, in other words, we're talking about people who were going to church or going to the mosque or going to the synagogue, so they're actually practicing the tick box of religion, but the actual spiritual aspect of it, the prayer, the connection to God, the love, the compassion, the transcendence, that's not really there. They're just doing the actual activity. It's very interesting to find that for them, the levels of well-being were the lowest. So what we came up with, and this is not just this particular study, but what we're showing quite consistently out of research is that the dimension of spirituality, that deeper connection with all that is around us, whether it's people or God, and the development of greater compassion and that transcendence, that is essential for the experience of greater well-being.
Yeah, very much so. And you see, I found that really interesting. You know, the idea of that search for meaning, you know, in life and our place. Even though maybe we don't have all the answers, but nonetheless, it creates a sense of well-being, you know. And I come from an area where people are I'm surrounded by a lot of people that, you know, high religion and low spirituality, and I just, you know, I mean, it makes sense because I see that, you know, and I see that in people's lives, and many are miserable, you know, that it's their lives just aren't in sync with some of the principles, you know, that many of the religions, you know, espouse. So, but
yeah, you know, in positive psychology, we have two kinds of happiness, two dimensions of happiness. One is called hedonic happiness, and that's the kind of happiness that we derive out of the pleasures of life. So, you know, when we eat a good chocolate cake, or when we get a raise at work, or when we buy a bigger car, so we get this feeling of pleasure. And that's hedonic happiness, and it's an important part of our happiness. But the more complex and more interesting aspect of happiness is called eudaimonic happiness. And eudaimonic happiness is what we experience when our lives are in line with our deepest held values. That's very interesting, and I think it reflects the point you were trying to make. So when we hold within ourselves a certain understanding of what do we truly value, what is meaningful for us, and then we live life according to it, then we find that life for us is filled with this really deep fulfillment. But obviously, if you think about that description that I've just offered, again, the greatest challenge is the challenge of awareness, because for a lot of people, it isn't very clear what are these deeply held values, what is that thing that is very meaningful, what is right for me. And in order for me to be able to answer that question, I need to know me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it was very interesting. One of the in your book, you have a, you know, part of that getting to know you, you know, type of situation. You have a psychological measurement, one of them called a personal need for structure questionnaire.
Yeah.
And so I went through that, you know, and it was interesting. Anyway, I went through that questionnaire. And found out, you know, after I mean, I didn't look at the end to see what the average was, but the average was, you know, and this was, you know, whether or not you have, you know, you feel comfortable with structure or change or uncertainty and that kind of thing. And anyway, I noticed that the average from your study was like a 3.1, and I found mine was a 2.75. So I think that means that I'm a little more comfortable with less structured situations.
Exactly. That's exactly what it means. So, as you said, I mean, I offer quite a few different psychological questionnaires as part of each chapter, because the book is structured as eight chapters, which are actually eight lessons, and each lesson I recommend going through for a full week, and then going through the different questions and insights that are involved in the chapter. And in that particular chapter, yes, we're talking about the experience of change. It's something very powerful about being able to say yes to the invitation for change. And as you said in that particular questionnaire, we're measuring our capacity to deal with a period of time in my life where things are not 100% structured and constructed and safe and clear. And what I've found from my personal experiences and from the experiences of my clients and students, that it's only when we allow ourselves to be at least a little bit in the unknown, at least a little bit in that question mark, only then could we change. Because only at that space, when we allow ourselves to move beyond the obvious, only then we allow new experiences, new insights, new ways of being, right? And that's a prerequisite for change.
Yeah, very much. We're already 40 minutes into the show, so I want to kind of go through a couple more topics here before we run out of time. One of them, you spend in lesson two, you talk about the meditative skill and meditation. So would you mind kind of talking a little bit about, you know, because you mentioned that, you know, the practice of meditation is seems to be vital in awareness and actually getting to that point of transcendence. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because even though many people hear meditation, I think some people still get the idea of you kind of have to do it in a certain way at a certain time. What's your kind of findings with regard to meditation and helping people raise awareness and get to that point?
Great. So first of all, I completely agree with you. I think it's interesting to find that still, when I say the word meditation, some people immediately imagine this guy with long dreadlocks and orange robe sitting at the top of a mountain in a meditative, rigid meditative posture, right? And he's been sitting there for 3.5 years. And meditation is so simple. Meditation is the moment where your awareness is meeting the here and now. That's it. Mm. When your attention is right there with whatever's happening, you're meditating. It's so simple. That's it. If you wash the dishes and every bit of your attention is with the soapy water and the temperature of the water and the scent of the liquid that you're using and you feel the sensations of the cleaning, then you're meditating. Yeah. If you wash the dishes and your mind is wandering to the things you need to do tomorrow at work and what you should have said to your friend yesterday and what you could have done, then obviously you're not there, you're not present, you're not meditating, right? And now you could apply what I've just said to any, and I really mean any activity. Any moment is an invitation to meditate. You could be jogging and meditating. How could you do that? By simply feeling every step, the sensations of your feet touching the ground, the wind touching your skin, the sweat pouring down your body. Really be there, breathe with these sensations, and you're meditating. If your mind wanders to, again, activities, things you could, should have done, then you're not there, you're not present, you're not meditating. So washing the dishes, running, speaking to a friend, any moment, any activity is an invitation for such an experience of meditation. Okay, so this is how I refer to meditation, and I think it's a simple definition, and I think it works, and I think it's also important to think about it this way because meditation, as I said earlier, sometimes people. People would come to me after, because I teach a lot of meditation classes and workshops, and I teach meditation teacher trainings, live online meditation teacher trainings that people can find on my website. And people come to me after classes, and they say to me, I've been there at the meditation. It was beautiful. I felt very, very peaceful, and I felt a connection to different sensations in the body. But you know what, Itai? I didn't see the white light, or I didn't feel enlightened afterwards, and it's very interesting because I think it's not just a reaction. It's one of those, there are a lot of myths around meditation. Like I'm supposed to be completely transformed by it, and meditation is such a simple, beautiful activity, and it is a skill. Now, going back to why is it a skill? So when we bring our attention to the moment, perhaps I should put it this way. Meditation is made out of two requirements to do with our awareness. The first requirement is, yes, bring your awareness to the moment. So, you know, if you're washing the dishes, you just wash the dishes. And if you're running, you just with the experience of running or whatever it is you're doing in the moment, bring your attention there. If you're sitting in front of the white wall and you're observing the wall, you just bring your attention to the whiteness. But that's not enough. The second requirement is that we bring our attention in what we call a non-reactive manner. In other words, our attention is right there with the temperature of the water or the feeling of the sensations of running, but we're not reacting to it. We're not allowing the mind to move into reaction mode and respond to these sensations. So let's make it more simple. I'm walking down the street and I'm seeing a flower, and the flower is beautiful. So I approach the flower and I breathe the scent and I look at the colors, which means that I'm meditating because my awareness is really fully 100% with the flower in the present moment. There's no reaction. There's just being with the flower. When the normal relationship in the normal state of consciousness would be, I approach the flower, I smell it, and immediately my mind goes into reactive mode, which is, oh, what a beautiful flower, I'd like to take it home, am I allowed to take it, would people say anything, and so on and so forth. This is the reactive mode, right? So if we are able to let go of that reactive mode and just really fully be with the flower as it is, we are meditating. And the more we practice this, the easier it becomes. This is why I'm talking about meditation as a skill.
Yeah.
Meditation is precisely like learning how to ride your bike. At the beginning, you learn how to ride your bike and you fall. And you fall again and again and again. And if you sit for breathing meditation, you will see that your mind, 10-minute practice, your mind probably wanders about 9 minutes out of the 10, which is 100% normal. This is how our mind is working. For most of us, the mind is conditioned to fluctuate. And we need to relearn how to control the mind. We need to relearn how to be able to choose where our awareness, where our attention is at any given moment. So what is it that we do? We sit and we breathe, for example, with breathing meditation, or the meditation of washing the dishes. It doesn't matter what the focal point is, but the point is that we bring our awareness to that focal point, we keep it there without reaction, we just breathe into that focal point, and then we find that our mind wandered. And it will happen, and then we bring it back to the focal point. And then after a little while, we find again that the mind is wandering, we bring it back to the focal point, and again, and again, and again, and again, just as you've done as a child when you fell from the bike. You got back on the bike and rode again and fell and got back on the bike until at some point you found yourself riding. And I don't know if you remember, but I remember as a child the feeling of, wow, I'm doing it, I'm actually riding. And obviously when I realized that, I fell again. But it doesn't matter. I felt this incredible freedom that came out of the control that I had over the bike, which is precisely the feeling we would have when we control attention, when attention doesn't fluctuate so rapidly as it is now, you know, the monkey mind. So we can choose where we want to focus our attention. And that's precisely why meditation is a skill that we can hone and enhance by practicing again and again and again. And when we practice it frequently, then we can choose where our awareness is at any given moment.
Exactly. Now, in your book, you talk about aware thinking and unaware thinking. So, is that the process of, you know, not being in the moment and in the experience and all of those other thoughts popping in? Is that the idea of unaware thinking?
Well, yes, and yet there's more to it. I think the reason for the fact that I wrote this chapter is that people came to me and they said, well, you know, it's impossible. I don't understand, how is it that meditation asks me not to think? And I thought it's really important to clarify the fact that we're not talking about not thinking, right? This isn't the point here. I think that I love the mind, and I love the ability to think and to be able to contemplate the world around me. And I think there's nothing wrong with thinking, and thinking is a beautiful experience as long as I can choose when to take a step back from thinking. So in a second, I'll explain exactly the difference between aware and unaware thinking, but I'm just sort of laying the foundation. The point is that because we live our lives the way that we do, and everything is happening so fast, and we demand from our cognition, from our thinking processes, we demand so much, and there are layers upon layers of thinking. And this is why most of us, at some point, feel really exhausted, because we have no capacity to take a step back from the thinking process, from the cognitive chattering mind, to be able to say, wait a second, stop. Right now, I don't need you. So when I go to bed at night and I put my head on the pillow, I want to be able to tell my mind, right now, I don't need you. I would like to let go of the blah, 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 and move into sleep. But most of us can't do that. We're at a point in history where one out of every four individuals in the UK and the US suffer from some kind of a sleeping disorder, which is related in some way to stress, anxiety. In other words, we want to go to sleep, but we can't. And why is that? Because our minds are overactive. The thinking processes take over. And that applies not only to sleep. It applies to pretty much any moment in life. You know, you sit with a friend in a restaurant, and you really love that person. You'd like to really be there, present, and listen to every word, and they share something with you that is really meaningful. And you suddenly find that your mind is wandering to dinner tonight or some other activity you need to do tomorrow, and it's very difficult to bring it back to this full attention you'd like to give this other person. In other words, what we need to learn is to have greater control over the mind, over attention, so that thinking becomes a healthy process. What is a healthy process? A healthy process, and that's what I differentiate between aware and unaware thinking. Aware thinking is the experience of thinking when I need to. So, for example, when we were, you and I were engaging in communication around this radio show, and when am I going to be hosted by you, I had to open my diary, and I had to think about the dates and compare the options, right? That was a cognitive, thinking-based process, and it was very important because I had to make a choice. When that's done, I would like to be able, when we have chosen a date, and then I would like to be able to then move to the next moment and be able to engage with the next moment completely, fully, as if the following moment did not exist. Because I've already made the choice, we've got the date. But what happens for most of us is that the former moment cling on to the next one. And this is where unaware thinking kicks in, which is the unhealthy thinking, where my mind is starting to obsess. So we've made a date. Is it the right date? How would the interview be? Should I prepare? Should I read? Should I say certain things? Should I make a list? Whoa, it's not really needed. We've got a date. Feels right. Move on. You know, it reminds me when I worked in a nursery when I was younger. You see children, and they engage in activities as if the former moment doesn't exist. So they could, for example, fight with a certain child, fight as if it's World War III, fight and scream and scratch, and you could see them, and I swear to God, a minute later, they could be sitting in the sand trap together, playing with sand, and as if that fight didn't exist. So the skill of of moving from one moment to the next without the backpack of the former moment is incredible. And we have lost that skill.
Very much. But, you know, Itai, we're down to the last 4 minutes here. We have just touched the surface of what you have to offer. And I have thoroughly enjoyed this. And now, on your website, people can go there. They can learn more about you, also the types of things you offer, the workshops, and also some of your research. And all of that is available at your website, correct?
Absolutely. So I invite the listeners to the website. As you said, there's information to do with the kind of work that I'm doing, with the classes that I'm teaching. I'm offering free webinars. I'm running meditation teacher training. So if people are interested in becoming meditation teachers, that I'm running live sessions that build up to a certification in meditation teacher training. And as you said, a lot of my research there, academic research, is there on the website as well. So I invite people to visit and really feel free to contact me if you have any questions or if you'd like to discuss anything.
Well, that's great. Well, Itai, this has really been a joy. I loved your book. I really, really like it. I'm going to go back and do some of those exercises again because they're very helpful. And like we said, they kind of open up the door, you know, to, you know, a better life, better way of thinking and making decisions.
Well, thank you very much, Robert. It was a real pleasure being hosted by you in this show.
Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Dr. Itai Itsan from the UK, and he is author of Awareness is Freedom, The Adventure of Psychology and Spirituality. And again, you can find more about him by visiting his website, which is awarenessisfreedom.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Bite Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.